Good morning. This is a podcast runs through it. I'm Nelson King here with Dixie Hart.
Good morning.
Today we're going to be interviewing Whitney Williams, who is running for governor. And that'll be the feature coming up a little bit later. But first, I wanted to bring up, this is primary season, and I want to remind everybody that it's time to think about getting registered, if you haven't already. If there are any questions about that, I'm shooing everybody to our website, apodcastrunsthroughit.com. Easy enough to get there, and we pretty much have all the data on when you need to be where and when the primaries are being held and registration procedures and that sort of thing. The primaries are going to be extremely important, particularly for statewide office, and we really want to encourage people to go and get registered if they're not already.
Absolutely, and while you're there, there's also a link. If you don't know if you're registered or not, there is a link there to a site where you can find that out also.
We get reminded from time to time that the people who listen to this probably vote. That's great. So what we're going to be talking about persistently for the next few months is getting other people to vote. Going to your friends, going to your relatives, going, well, those you can get along with. Go to those people that you think might vote and push them to vote. And that's going to be very important because it's a multiplier game. The more people who vote, the more people will ask other people to vote. And you get a climate, a culture, a voting. It sounds simple, but it takes effort.
So everybody out there, spread the word. Voting in 2020 is cool.
That's cool.
Way cool.
Anyway, this is a podcast runs through it, coming to you from Sound Color Studios in Livingston, Montana. And we're now going to get on with our interview with Whitney Williams. Good morning. This is morning, which is unusual for us. This is a podcast runs through it, and we're going to do this morning an interview with Whitney Williams. Now, that name should ring a bell one way or another. And Whitney, I'm glad you could make it. It's a, well, it's a typical winter day here in Livingston, and windy and not too warm, not too cold, and I'm glad you could make it.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And you're running for governor.
I am.
Which is not a trivial effort.
Yeah.
By any means. And I'd like to get into today, you know, your positions on issues and things like that, but I think a lot of people are just interested in what brings you to running for governor. So we can start with a little bit of your background and where you're coming from, both in terms of, well, you have a history, we know that. Mm-hmm. But where are you coming from, both in terms of upbringing and education and that sort of thing?
So. Great. Well, thanks again for having me. Big fan of this podcast. So glad you're doing it from beautiful Livingston, where it is a little sunny and a little cold today. I'm Whitney Williams. I'm a sixth generation Montanan. My family came here to Harrison originally during the Gold Rush, and then kind of made their way to Jefferson City and then to Butte, ultimately becoming sort of miners and maids and waitresses and a mayor. My grandpa Hannah was the popular mayor of Butte back in the 50s and early 60s. And then I've got some pretty extraordinary parents, some folks will know. My father, Pat Williams, was our longest serving congressman from Montana. And
7 terms, I think?
So nine.
9 terms.
Yeah, 9 terms. Yeah. Yep. He was elected in 78 and he stayed until 97 when he was homesick. Missed Montana too much and wanted to come back and teach. He was a teacher, elementary school teacher, before he was elected. And then my mother, who went on to become the first female majority leader of the state Senate. Also, she reminds me, first female minority leader. She preferred the majority, for the record.
Yeah.
So I do come from this sort of long line of, you know, tough, kind of hardworking from the homesteaders on through to my folks. And I sort of used that grit and determination to start my own business. So 20 years ago, I started a company, work along Fortune 500 companies and private citizens. Williams Works, yep. Mm-hmm. So that's the name of the company, which I started on my own and then have hired and trained up a whole bunch of folks over the years. and have been very focused on helping people here at home and across the globe who are struggling. So we've worked on some pretty extraordinary projects, a number of them with small farmers across the planet. Most recently, been doing a project in Puerto Rico. Remember that Hurricane Maria, which sort of devastated the island in a variety of ways, including the agriculture right. sector and coffee in particular. Mm. And so I led an effort that brought together coffee companies, some competitors, actually, Starbucks and Nespresso, along with some private philanthropy and nonprofits, and then worked closely with government, including Sonny Perdue, who's the current Secretary of Agriculture. We needed a waiver to bring a climate-resilient seed on the island, and we got that done. And we've helped now about 4,000 coffee farmers get back to work, which we're very proud of. And so I've loved my business and my work. It's a thrilling job with extraordinary job creators and business leaders and change makers. And at the end of the day, I'm a Montanan. I love my state more than anything. It really did sort of make me who I am, and I worry about our state. I think folks are struggling. I'm sure it's true here in Livingston, like it is in all the small communities and lots of rural communities and small towns and our cities. I feel like people are having a hard time. Mm-hmm. And I think that it was time for me to step into the arena. So 5 months ago, I made the decision, made the announcement to do that. I think that my background as someone who is a business person, but someone who cares deeply about people who are struggling, but also has this deep sense of public service and public policy, and believe very much that government can and should do right by folks. And I think that my experience and my skill set is going to lend itself really well to the future of this state. I think we've got a lot of new challenges before us, and I think it needs a new problem-solving and solution set. Mm-hmm. So here I am.
Well, yeah, and I think we want to explore a little bit what brings you to the table, and your track record basically is, I guess I could say, is a problem solver, and in many cases, a big problem solver. You've worked for corporations, you've worked for governments, you've worked for individuals and organizations, mostly with very interesting and challenging projects mm-hmm. for a long time, and that's actually what your business did. And it had a lot of aspects to it, but the main thing I took away from reading about your history is that you were a problem solver and could handle scale. In other words, little things, one farmer at a time, or a million farmers if that was the deal. The thing is, it struck me that you come from a family where, one way to put it would be that your politics was around the dinner table. Mm-hmm. You grew up with it.
Sure was. Yeah.
And I know from personal experience that if any profession where you grow up with it, mm-hmm. the language, the mentality, the thinking, the issues, you kind of take it by osmosis almost, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when you come around to running, you actually know the political jargon, you know the political layout because you grew up with it. And it's a different prospect than somebody who went through legislature or some other administrative office. So I'd like you to talk about how you see your background being used as governor.
Yeah.
Because it's different than, let's say, the people who came up to the legislature or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think primarily, having been an executive and having been a job creator and a business owner, that's just it is a different skill set than our friends who serve in public office. And I'm very grateful to everyone who serves in public office for sure. I just think that's, the skill set of, being an executive, creating jobs, managing budgets, managing payroll, paying taxes. I happen to be one of the 115 or so thousand small businesses in Montana. And I think that is just, there's a different sort of sensibility and different approach to the way in which we bring people together. I happen to really enjoy working with unlikely allies, people who don't necessarily agree with us, including our Republican friends and independent friends. We've worked across the aisle on a variety of issues dating back to foster care issues with former Speaker Tom DeLay, who happened to be, obviously very conservative, and we thought very differently about many issues, but he happened to be a foster dad. And so we worked with him to get some things done at the national level for foster kids. So, I really do think that problem solving and genuine joy, bringing people together, is something that I think is important in a leader and in an executive who, you know, who's going to run the state. And certainly, you know, to your point about being raised in it, you know, my brother, sister, and I feel very lucky to be Montanans first and foremost, and very lucky to be kids of my mom and dad who, you know, really did lead by example and certainly brought all of the issues that we're facing Montanans home on a daily basis. You know, the stories that you would hear, you know, I'm from Butte, as I said, my family comes from there. I was raised in Helena. But when that mine closed in Butte, you know, we all remember it for those of us who were here. But my uncle Bobby lost his job overnight. You know, they put a padlock up and locked everybody out and it was over. So it was very personal too for us in terms of, you know, what did it mean to lead into the future? And then listening to these stories of, again, folks who were struggling and just needed a little bit of, you know, a little bit of support. Mm-hmm. And we heard day in and day out about those stories. And again, you know, have this real belief in public policy and public service and that there's real dignity in serving. And so, so I finally decided that it was really time for me to, you know, that old saying about stepping into the arena. I think we all need to do something to help our state and our country right now. And this felt like the right time and place for my skill set to put to work.
Mm-hmm. One thing that we've kind of noticed, it's, you could call it a thread, but almost everybody that we've interviewed, and we've done, you know, a lot of them now, is this, I'd say it's innate desire to work with other people, mm-hmm. including people you don't get along with or don't agree with or, yeah. you know.
Great.
And that, I hate to say it, but that's not normal now.
Yeah.
It used to be.
Yeah.
How do you bridge that gap? How do you get started working with people that really don't want to? They're mm-hmm. ideologically or otherwise, you know, oh, no, you're a liberal, I won't deal with you, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
How do you approach that?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. I mean, I think I always think of this beautiful Maya Angelou saying, you know, we're more alike, my friends, than we are unalike. And I think that sums up Montana. I really do. And look, I've been around the block. I know how tough things can be politically here. And also, you know, you never see one car by the side of the road in Montana. You always see two. Somebody stopped to help their neighbor. We know you don't build a barn or fence on your own. So I do think that there is this real beauty in the way in which we care for our neighbors in this state. And I think if we can keep our common Montana and our common sort of humanity about us, I do actually think people want to work together. I really do. And I think if we have that spirit, and I'm really glad you're hearing that from others. I've heard it on a few of the podcasts recently as well. And I think that's what's just required, you know, at this moment in our history, which is really, you know, scary, right? There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of anger, I think, in lots of parts of America. I find going around, we're on a 56 county tour right now. We've been spending a lot of time. We were in Terry and Sydney and Culbertson this week. And I'll tell you, what I hear is fear. I don't hear anger from people. People are scared. They're scared about what's going to happen to family farms and ranches. They're scared about
healthcare.
Obviously, yes, they certainly are. Right. And I think that's, you know, something that we have in common, which is then, okay, well, then now how do we work together to solve some of those problems? So I'm glad you're hearing that, because we are too, and we really are hearing people saying, you know, sort of enough is enough. We want to work together and do everything we can to...
Yeah, I mean, polarization has gotten to the point it's almost schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. It is ugly, to say the least.
Yep.
So when you get together with people, when you work with people, it sounds like you would start with issues.
Yeah.
I'm not asking you at the moment to prioritize, because in a way that's a dumb question. Everybody works with a bunch of issues, and from day to day they change a bit in terms of priority. But what, you know, where would you start as governor?
Yeah. Yeah, well, let me tell you about three things that we're hearing a lot and three things that I'm very focused on. One, we just talked about healthcare. 40% of Montanans will tell us on a regular basis that they choose between filling a prescription and putting food on the table. Remember when Brian Schweitzer did those bus trips. He did 4 bus trips to Canada. He did 1 flight to Mexico during that time. And back then, which was just 20 years ago, mm-hmm. a vial of insulin was $20. Today, it's a minimum of $275. So folks are worried.
Mm-hmm. Right. What's gone wrong here?
Right?
Yeah.
Yep.
And you know what we've seen, which is really, I think, exciting, and I think there is a light at the end of the tunnel, which is, you know, states like Tennessee recently passed a piece of legislation that caps insulin prices for a 30-day supply at $100. I think that that could be done here as well. I think Governor can lead on this issue in a variety of ways, including, you know, we're starting to see again some of our neighboring states starting to think about how do we start to put together pools like a state employees together and start negotiating our own.
Right.
And then transparency, right? We don't have any transparency on pharma. Don't you think if folks saw what it made, what it cost to make a vial of insulin and what the markup was, things would start to change. Mm-hmm. We had some good legislation brought this time in the legislature and didn't make it through, unfortunately, on price transparency. But I think there are some things like that. And certainly what we're finding across the state is that that pharma issue is a real issue and it affects every single family. Right. Really does. So that's one thing that I'm real focused on. The second is education, but specifically, you know, pre-K, you know, Montana is still just one of 12 states that doesn't educate our 4-year-olds. When my mom was the leader of the Senate, Brian Schweitzer happened to be governor at that time, and they got full-day kindergarten done, which had taken, you know, a long time to get done, but it finally got done. It's made a huge difference for all the little ones in this state, but also for the economy. I mean, who's got money? In Missoula, I'll tell you, we've got some friends at the university who, you know, they've got good jobs. They have 2 kids, sort of Irish twins, like me and my sister. When the littles were born, they said, we set up a college fund. And when they got out of pre-K, the college fund was gone. It's $900 a month to put a kid through pre-K. So it's an economic issue, you know, for folks as well. And I think that's something that we've got to get done. And then on the other end, I think we need to make sure we have pathways to good paying jobs through apprenticeship programs and trades and community colleges. I was lucky. I went to the University of Montana. I got a degree there. I wouldn't change a thing about my experience, but for lots of students, younger and older, who want to get a job, you know, working with their hands, we should be excited about that and we should support it in every way we can. So that's another thing that we're hearing a lot of, you know, friends, again, is every part of the state, every corner of the state, talking about how important it is to have, you know, really robust community colleges, make sure that we're funding them and make sure that there's increased pathways to that. And then the last thing, which is just a, you know, obsession for each one of us sitting here around this table, is public lands.
Right.
I mean, public lands are our identity. They're our heritage. We have the biggest share of our economy, of course, 70,000 jobs rely on the conservation, you know, economy and the tourism economy, outdoor industry. Here in Montana, it is a cash register for this state. We ought to treat it like that. And what we know is happening in Washington is this Trump administration's focus on transferring those lands back to the states. And Montanans know what that's about. It's about selling it off to wealthy out-of-staters and big corporate interests and taking it away from the public. And so, you know, every day that we travel around, those are the things that we're hearing from folks, and those are the things that they want us focused on. And so that's what I'm thinking a lot about and excited to roll up my sleeves and get to work on.
Mm-hmm. Now, you sort of characterized what you're hearing as fear.
Yeah.
So anger sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I always think of the governor's position as a lightning rod. Mm. Governor hears everything, pretty much. The issue for a governor is to take what they hear and try to translate it into solutions. And
that's right.
To do that, I may have to remind people, the governors don't write legislation. Well, not directly. Usually they're involved. But how do you see yourself taking what you hear and translating it into real legislation or real programs or...
Yeah.
In the context of being a governor, you know.
Yeah, no, great. You know, I would do it the same way that I've run my business, which is asking lots of questions, listening to folks and stakeholders across the board and whatever the issue might be, making sure we take into account everything we can do. And then again, it's back to that working with others and enjoying that, bringing unlikely allies together and really thinking about like the innovation too. You know, what can we learn from others? You know, some of these, many of the problems that we face, some of them are problems of the past, but some of them are going to be the problems of the future. We don't quite know yet what those are. So really relying on innovators. And I would say number one, those come from Main Streets in Montana. My dad used to say there's a genius on every block. And that was right, which is that locally folks know what's best for their communities. So when we think about how do we put that together to solve those problems, but asking lots and lots of questions and listening, I think is centrally, certainly defines me as a leader and has in my success in business. But similarly would be so as governor. You know, the governor is also sort of the ambassador, right? The representative of families, both here at home and outside of the state and outside of this country, right? We've got huge trading partners across the globe that we need to have good relationships with. We have job creators all across this country who are interested in the, you know, extraordinary beauty and community that we have here in Montana, who might be willing to do more, you know, and locate here or help us think through some of the sort of challenges or opportunities ahead of us. So it's really back to sort of bringing people together, listening, learning, mm-hmm. and then acting.
Now, in some ways, people would say you have a small business perspective, mm-hmm. which you do.
Yep.
Background.
Yep.
What you've done for a living, that sort of thing. And most people, not most, but a lot of people associate that with a Republican point of view.
Mm.
But you're obviously not.
Yeah.
Right. And you bring a, I guess I could say social consciousness to that.
Yep.
To a degree that you don't find in every business person.
Yep.
How do you say that? How do you think that informs what you would do and how you would react to things as a governor? Mm.
Yeah. Good question. Yeah. I mean, as a, again, you know, small business owner, I think that there are, you know, a set of problems that we have to solve, opportunities before us, decisions about, you know, the decisions about what to do with my business, about hiring and firing, about healthcare, about payroll, about, you know, local taxes, state taxes, right? The reality of operating a business, which of course is the backbone of this state in many ways. I think that has really set me up to be successful, certainly in business, but also in this idea of leadership, right? And what does it take to be an executive and a successful executive, and how do we bring folks together? And ultimately, you know, my business does care about people. It was set up on the idea that we wanted to support folks who were struggling, and we wanted to bring all kinds of assets to the table. So corporate assets, you know, individual families, ideas, innovations, and help create jobs for people across the globe.
Can you give us an example? What sticks out in your mind of all the projects you've worked on as a business person? Is there something or one or two that stick out in your mind as having really represent what you're trying to do?
Yeah, there's a few. So one, I would say this this Puerto Rico issue after Hurricane Maria. You know, there's these farmers who lost everything. Overnight, the trees were literally gone. They were either uprooted or just destroyed. And so when 80% of the coffee trees were gone, it's not only an economic engine for those families and for the island, but it's also their culture and their heritage. I mean, Puerto Rican coffee, the Pope drinks it. I mean, it's a really big part of their identity, not unlike maybe wheat is, you know, for us. And so the idea that the whole entire industry might be gone was pretty devastating to those farmers. And so bringing together corporations and private philanthropy and government to really do very quick, by the way, like urgently solve that problem, because you can't, we've got to get climate resilient seeds on the island. We've got to make sure that they get there within the time frame we need them to get there to be able to germinate, to get in the ground during planting season, et cetera. And also, coffee trees take 3 years to be productive. And so we needed to make sure that we had, you know, moved with real urgency to helping those folks. That one's a good example. We've also worked alongside America's Heroes, so post 9/11 veterans. Worked with the founder of Starbucks, Howard Schultz, and his wife, Sherry, and their wonderful foundation to help them launch a $30 million initiative, which has helped put post 9/11 vets back to work. Also had some psychosocial counseling and some other elements, but really thinking about these considerable skills that our veterans have. How do we sort of make sure that they're able to get a job that really fits their extraordinary expertise? That's been really great. And then we've also done some really interesting work around child sex trafficking. So with a little bit of a layer around MMIW and the Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women problem we certainly have here in Montana, but bringing the technology companies together with law enforcement to help develop tools so that they could go find children more quickly. So the FBI actually here in Montana now uses that tool, which we're thrilled about. But again, that's really sort of saying, okay, there's a challenge here, there's a problem, and what are all the assets we can bring to bear to help solve that? And so across the business now for about 18 years, we've been doing that across lots of different issues, just like the issues that Montanans are facing. So, you know, again, this sort of small towns and rural communities, which we're very focused on in this campaign, and of course, we'll be spending lots of time in the cities as well, but you know, what we do think is that people are struggling in ways that we need to really start to think about innovative ways to deal with and really get to problem solving as quickly as we can. And I will say, moving with urgency into a clean energy future. You know, Montana, I just got out of the car and walked here. I will say you guys are about as windy as anyone. I mean,
we're the unofficial windy city.
Yes, we are.
You really are. I mean, and the wind potential is really extraordinary in Montana.
Exactly.
And solar too. And we need to move, I think, with urgency into this clean, renewable energy future. And by the way, do so while thanking our community, Colstrip, and all those folks who've kept the lights on all these years, and then helping them transition in all the ways that we're going to need to help them transition. But broadly, I believe that we can move much more quickly into a clean energy future, and we need to do that. It's going to result in good-paying jobs. It's ultimately going to relate to the bottom line for every single family because its power is going to be cheaper. And lots of states are doing that, and I think we need to move more quickly into that future.
Yeah, I'm not sure this is a totally accurate characterization, but a lot of people we interview, our legislators have legislation in their background, and they look at issues. They've met a lot of issues through the legislative process, and they do research, and their staffs do research and that sort of thing. And I think one of the things you're talking about is you've dealt with many of these same issues, but from a totally different perspective, from somebody outside of government whose business it was to look at problems and issues, but find, an eclectic solution rather than, well, it's legislative. We get this done, that done, that done. We get it finished. You're looking at it from the perspective of what pieces can I put together?
Yeah, and that includes the legislature, I will say. You know, and another thing I think is really important is that we make sure that we get the best possible people elected to the legislature. I mean, we're just talking about clean renewables. We got to get great people elected to the Public Service Commission. You guys had Tom Woods on
recently. Yes.
It's I'm cheering for him. I think he'd be great. And I think that's also, frankly, role of anyone running for governor or especially these statewide offices is to do everything we can to help the other boats rise. You know, back in the days of Schweitzer, who I've mentioned a few times, but Brian, you know, we had 5 land board seats and we have just one now, and you know, Steve has been an extraordinary governor. I went to elementary school with Steve. He was getting A's then, and he's still getting A's in my book. And he's got a lot to contend with. And I think that we need to do everything we can as leaders to help make sure that others get elected, because we do need to work with the legislature. We do need to work with, you know, the Public Service Commission. And we do have these Tier B seats, which are centrally important to all the issues that I think Montanans care about. And we need really good people who are representing the value set of Montana. And I think we've got some turnover needed in those Tier Bs.
Right. Yeah. And we've been bringing up the land board with all the candidates who actually their office would have a
Great.
Seat on the land board.
Great.
And it really feels like you... definitely see the importance of getting the right people on that board.
Absolutely.
If we have an agenda, it's to make people aware of these statewide offices and groups like the Land Board.
Great.
Or the Public Service Commission that most people don't know much about.
Yeah, great.
And yet they're very important. Mm-hmm. Let's just take the Land Board for an example. The governor sits on the Land Board, as do most of the administrative executive mm-hmm. statewide offices. Mm-hmm. How do you envision, assuming you can flip enough seats at the mm-hmm. Land Board, mm-hmm. how do you envision using the Land Board? What you know, this is by way of explaining to people what it does mm-hmm. and what it can do.
Yeah, great. Well, I'm first of all grateful to you all for calling this out and making sure that we do educate folks, because they don't know. I mean, you know, most of the folks walking around don't really have a sense for some of the importance
right.
Of these other positions, which is really centrally important. I do think on the Land Board, you know, one of the things, again, back to our identity, truly, as Montanans, we all share this love of the outdoors and making sure that we keep our public lands public, and making sure that we protect them from wealthy out-of-state corporations and out-of-staters who wish to do other things with them. And I think the leadership on the Land Board, again, allows us to do that. And if we can get more people on it, which we will, knocking on wood,
hopefully,
this time,
yes,
it will really help, because, you know, issues like mining on the banks of rivers will come up. And permitting questions will come up before the Land Board, and the Land Board gets to vote on that. And you got to have 3 votes on that Land Board to make sure that we can stop some of those things from happening or green light other ones that should. And that's centrally important, I think. And again, you know, I think this more alike than unalike, overwhelmingly Montanans agree that we want to keep our public places pristine. And by the way, they also agree that we want to keep access open.
And that's a big issue.
It really is. And, you know, what we're seeing, of course, is we want to welcome, Montanans are welcoming folks. We're happy to have people come and spend their money. And certainly if they want to buy a home here, they can do that. But what we see is that increasingly wealthy out-of-staters are buying up big tracts of land. They're taking agricultural productivity off the table. They're putting up no trespassing signs. And by the way, led by Greg Gianforte.
Right.
Put up that no trespassing sign, didn't let people get to the Gallatin River, a river that's rightly and truly ours, and then sued the state to try to keep us out of our river. I mean, it's shocking. So that sort of thing, I think, certainly in terms of Gianforte, those are not Montana values. They're just not. And I think that, you know, idea that we need to sort of stay steady and stay focused, and again, back to this Land Board, have the majority of that Land Board to make sure that we can continue to access these public lands, that we can keep these public lands in public hands, and we can stop like a wholesale sell-off, which is what all Montanans agree about. And so if we can get everybody convinced that the Land Board is important for these other reasons.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yes.
Yeah, that's the
which
thing
you guys can help with.
Bringing up the awareness that the Land Board can do things that the legislature could do but probably won't because it's too complicated, but the Land Board can, and it's only 5 people, right?
That's right.
You make decisions or put restrictions on or whatever you want to call it, you're a first line of defense for these various kinds of land issues.
And that's right.
Okay, probably right. Enough said about the Land Board, yeah. But we keep trying to run it.
Yeah, great.
Run people into that these offices and these boards and things like that have a lot to do with the quality of life here in Montana, and in a way that's often not even known or understood.
Exactly, and this election is a pivotal one, because it's going to decide whether or not we're going to keep the quality of life that
that's
we
right.
all appreciate having here in the state.
That's right. It absolutely is.
So another one of our missions is also to get people to vote.
Great.
So, you know, informing people, the voters, and also registering voters, participating in the process, basically.
Great.
Is our mission.
Good. Yeah, people just getting involved. You know, there's these incredible organizations across the state. I've been really fortunate to be a part of groups like Forward Montana, which is amazing young people who I swear they are so clever. You know what they did in the polls in Missoula last election? I live in over in Missoula. And it was out at the county fairgrounds and a bunch of kids were lined up and it was really cold in November. And they brought a litter of kittens. And they passed the kittens around the line and everybody took their mind off the fact that they were cold and waiting in line. And by the time, before they knew it, they were inside and they were voting.
Oh, that's great.
I mean, that is such an extraordinary organization. Or Montana Conservation Voters.
Yes.
You know, really focused on getting people, you know, registered and then out to vote, which really takes a ground game, right? It takes a lot of people in a state this size. Or Montana Native Vote. You know, they're amazing. They're doing all of the work, both on census right now, which is also centrally, of course, important to Montana. But then getting people registered, which we got to make sure people are registered for this primary by May 2nd. And then get them an absentee if they're not going to be around. And then get them out to vote. In Montana, you know, we have one of the highest turnouts in the country.
Right.
Historically.
Well, Livingston had the one of the highest in the nation.
Awesome.
In the midterms in 2018.
Great.
Yeah.
Great.
It was 73%.
Good
turnout.
Work. Awesome. Yeah, that turnout was no joke last time.
Yeah.
You know, because it was the, I believe, extraordinary John Tester who, you know, was going to keep Montana, Montana. And that's what I'm here to do as well. But John worked so hard and people know him. They know where he comes from. They trust him. They believe him. And that turnout reflected that.
Well, yeah. And it was like almost 73% for Park County. And but John Tester got 78%.
Yeah. All right. Way to go, John. Big
Which,
Sandy.
Which in a way is actually the turnout because that's, they didn't vote for everything, but they did vote for him. That's what I think probably, I don't know if that's an issue for you, but you know, we have a history in Montana of electing people who are kind of against the grain. In a strictly Republican turning era, we still elect Democratic senators and representatives and governors and so forth. And I imagine you want to tap into that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you know, you don't get elected as a Democrat in Montana without Republican friends and independents voting
exactly
for you. Remember Bullock, you know, pulled off that election in 16. I think Steve won by almost 5 points. And Trump beat Hillary by 20 or something like that, right? So
that was
pretty remarkable because Montanans are independent thinkers. And that's, I think, what's reflected. I mean, regularly we sort of split the ticket in that way. We'll vote for a Republican and we'll vote for a Democrat. And I think that's just that independence that we sort of have. Maybe it's the homesteading spirit. I don't know. Though I will say I am super proud to be a sixth generation Montanan, but I was at an event the other day with my friend Denise Juno, who endorsed me. And I said, I'm very proud to have Denise's endorsement. And I said, I'm a sixth generation Montanan to the crowd. And Denise from the corner said, I'm 50th. And I said, yep, hats off, Denise. Absolutely. It is true. Speaking of voter turnout, Indian country, I mean, the folks, urban and rural Indians, folks on reservations and off, vote at record high numbers, which I'm very proud of. And I think, you know, some of my work with Montana Native Vote and others over the years.
College work had involved Native American studies, right?
It did, yeah. Native American studies degree. And I worked really hard. You know, I University of Montana, they required you to take a language before you graduated, and I just couldn't find a language that I wanted to take. And I also wonder, why are we not teaching a tribal language at this school? Here we are a few miles from Salish Kootenai and, you know, not that far from Blackfeet. And so I went to my advisor and said, hey, what do you think about tribal language? And they said, well, we don't have any. And I said, well, but we could. They said, well, if you can find someone. So I went up to the reservation to Salish College and couldn't quite work it out there. And then I called my old friend Earl Oldperson, who I've known my whole life, and said, can I come up to Blackfeet and see you? And I have an idea. This was a 19-year-old Whitney Williams, I think, maybe 20. I went up and saw Earl, drove up to Browning in my little Bronco, and Earl saw me, and I said, I really want to bring Blackfeet language to the University of Montana, and I'll take it, and I'll do whatever I can. I'll recruit friends if I need to do that? And he said, well, sure, of course. And so introduced me to this extraordinary man who became my professor, Marvin Weatherwax, whose son is now in the legislature. And Marvin came down to the University of Montana. The University of Montana said, okay, we'll give you space for the summer, a classroom, but we can't put you in the course book because it was just about to come out. It had already been printed. So I went around and I put flyers up and I recruited my sister and my boyfriend at the time and anyone I could get. Bill Farr joined us. I mean, this amazing collection of 12 students. And we started the Blackfeet Language Program at the university, which was
excellent.
Really, really great. Total honor to be able to, though I do not speak the language. I will just say that is a very beautiful and very hard language to speak.
Makes an interesting project, though.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Sure does.
Are there any other issues? I noticed that your plate's pretty full of, I guess this would really be expected, but I noticed one thing we haven't talked about is housing, which is a big issue in this state.
Sure it is.
And getting bigger.
Yep.
And it's related to a lot of the other issues as well. Income disparity, jobs, unequal pay, different parts of the state having different kinds of economic climates, et cetera. What's your take on that?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I mean, affordable housing, it's true, it's an issue for everybody, you know, and high property taxes certainly affecting homeowners, but also affecting renters, right? It's really, really an issue. You know, one thing I think we need to take a real serious look at is how, as a state, we don't offer any kind of tax credit for developers to build. The feds do, so there's some federal tax credits that folks can take advantage of, but we don't offer state tax credit. And I think incentivizing more developers to help build more affordable housing is one of the things we should really take a look at. I do think we've got some friends over in the western side of the state who are building some affordable housing units in Helena, and it's going to work. I mean, it's really helpful, and I think it'll be good, and it won't be enough, right? There still needs to be more. And so I think we certainly need to sort of start to take a look at property taxes, which is a part of it. But I think we also need to develop more affordable housing. And you guys, certainly here in Livingston, with
it's
this Bozeman
problem.
Challenge, right? I met with a builder in Bozeman last week who told me also that he bid a house and he bid it at $80,000 for lumber. And with the tariff challenges we're having, it went to $160,000 overnight. And he'd already bid it. So what does he do? And he doesn't use steel a lot in his construction, but friends of ours who do use steel in construction similarly, I mean, the tariffs are affecting everybody, not to mention our farmers and farming communities in the state who literally overnight had nowhere to sell their product.
Right.
And so those are national issues for sure, but certainly that affect a governor and a state dramatically. And we've got to think about how do we sort of protect ourselves and what more is it that we could be doing to make sure that we're taking care. It is, you know, centrally, thematically, something that I feel strongly about, back to the pharma and prescription drug issues that we were talking about. You know, the federal government, as much as I wish this was the federal government of the days of Pat Williams, it's not. And the federal government is not doing the things that we need them to do. I mean, back to this Schweitzer 20 years ago and the insulin prices, Montana's got to stick up for itself. And I think there are a variety of ways in which we can do that. And I do believe in affordable housing, that there are some solution sets. Now, we've got to convince some of our friends in the legislature to do that, no question. But there are people ready and willing to get to work. But there do need to be some incentives to do that.
Right.
Yeah, I don't have the statistics at the top of my head, but I've been hearing other, read and heard on podcasts and so forth, that the scope of the problem for housing is way bigger than most people think it is. We build something like 1.5 million homes a year or dwellings, and we need 5 million to handle just the backlog of people that are looking for homes.
Yep.
Or looking for housing.
Yep.
And the reason I bring it up is because it to me anyway, it ought to be a bipartisan issue.
Mm-hmm. Sure it should.
But it's not.
Yeah, sure it should.
Why is that? And as a governor, how would you handle that so that you can get over the barriers that have been erected against housing and government being involved in housing in some way? It's pretty clear it has to be a partnership of a lot of different factors, but how do you manage
it? It does,
that?
And I think, again, back to my background of bringing public and private sector together, that's what you do here. And I do think, you know, at the end of the day, I believe a budget is a reflection of our values, right? You look at a budget, whether it's your own budget in your house, what do we spend money on? Same thing is true with the state, right? And the governor gets to put forward a budget. And I do think that some of these ideas like tax credits for developers to help us get on track here in Montana and build housing that folks can afford is one of those things that we can be looking at. And that is a private sector and government. It absolutely requires the legislature to come along, but it also requires the private sector to say, yeah, I'm willing to do that. So I do think that this sort of working together, both with government inside and outside, and bringing people to the table, listening to all opinions, asking lots of questions, and then getting together to problem solve around that is the way you lead.
And it's not an ideological issue.
No, certainly not.
It's a problem-solving issue.
Yeah.
Which is what we keep talking about, you know.
That's right.
Are there any other issues that you want to bring up, or Dixie?
I think, well, you know, we recently did one of our episodes was about money in politics.
Mm.
And in fact, we called it Money Changes Everything. And mainly it came up because of another candidate that was running for governor, Riley Neal, who dropped out. And she mentioned that one of the reasons she dropped out was because of money.
Yep.
And we had been already talking about the outrageous amounts of money that were being spent, not just nationally, but in Montana. I mean, amounts that are just...
Yeah, tens of millions of dollars.
Yes,
yeah.
Insane. And it doesn't look like there's any limit to it. And I'm old enough to remember, and I think your father was a real champion of campaign finance reform.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, how do we put limits on this? And particularly since Citizens United, it's just gotten out of hand.
Yep.
And, well, you yourself set a record.
Yep.
For the amount of money raised in
yep.
one quarter
yep.
in Montana. And, you know, I mean, we all realize that, you know, the election season's on, game's on, too late to change the rules. But how do you see this? How do we get this under control going forward? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, it's such an important issue. And, you know, Citizens United, and when that decision came down, right, allowing unlimited money in politics and treating corporations like people, it was, I think, the single worst day in my lifetime.
Yeah.
And gets the most serious issue in my lifetime. You remember the McCain-Feingold. People remember
right.
that, those two, you know, extraordinary senators, one Republican and one Democrat, who came together to try to solve campaign finance reform years ago and couldn't get it done. Citizens United then happened, and big hats off to Steve Bullock when he was Attorney General, you know, argued that, hey,
yeah.
wait, Montana's corporations are not people. That's in our Constitution here. So it was unconstitutional, unfortunately. The decision was the decision, and it truly was the worst decision. I think I'm going to knock on wood here and hope we don't have more bad decisions like that coming from the Supreme Court, but it was a terrible one. I will say this, Montana, again, led by Steve, because Steve was so focused on this as governor, keeping sort of dark money out of politics in Montana
right.
is really progressive. I mean, the way in which he's done that work and the sort of life's work that he's spent now over the last decade doing that is really impressive, and Montana should be very thankful to him, because we do have much stronger state laws here in the state about what we can and can't accept as people running for governor, for example. And so folks should know that we do have much better laws here in Montana. That said, we also have the opportunity for any wealthy person like billionaire Greg Gianforte to self-fund.
Exactly.
He will use every penny to win this governor's race. I believe he wants it more now than he did last time. And he said on a number of occasions that he'll spend whatever it takes. So there is no regulating that, because he can still spend whatever he wants. And so I think, you know, in our case, we did set a record in Montana. The largest amount of money raised by any gubernatorial candidate in our history, any Democrat, was raised by us in our first quarter. And while all of this feels a little bit like a heist because it's of democracy, you got to do it. And we're certainly not going to disarm next to a billionaire who's trying to change our way of life.
Right.
But it's a problem. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, you know, I looked at that number and I actually found myself going, yoo-hoo, you know, at least we have a chance.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the way things are right now when you're running against millions and millions of dollars.
A couple of things we've been emphasizing is that we have adopted, I guess, in this country, the notion that if you raise a lot of money, you must be good. And that's one problem.
That's one. Yeah. And then another one is if you raise enough money, you don't actually have to go out and campaign.
Talk to people.
You don't have to talk to people.
Totally.
People don't get an opportunity to ask you what your issues are or, you know, how you're going to deal with their problems.
Now, that's on a national
you don't
level,
have to
that
do
might
that.
Not, you know,
that's right.
Obviously, you're not going to meet every candidate and it's not going to see everybody in the country.
Yep.
But in Montana.
Yep, that's right.
That's a different story.
It sure is. And that's for us. That's why we are on a proper 56-county tour. We're doing town halls everywhere we can. We're doing coffees everywhere we can. We were in Glendive last night with, you know, 40 folks who came to show up to ask questions. We spent a couple of hours together. We're going to do that every day, everywhere that will have us, in the littlest towns as well, because I think we don't sometimes show up enough when there's not as many people. It's just practical, but we aren't going to do that because I do think that it's important to show up. You know, the idea that I really and truly want to represent all of Montana, not some of Montana. I really believe that. And I think that back to the money in politics, you know, what you're finding, certainly with Gianforte, is that he puts up ads. He's now, you know, full-time on the air now. He's already gone up.
Exactly.
Which means he'll be up the whole time. You know, he'll be on the air the whole time. And he's not doing town halls. He's not showing up to debates. He's not talking to folks.
Well, he hasn't done any town halls. I mean, there's nothing really that indicates he's going to change that. And meanwhile, what we are seeing is, you know, the Democratic candidates for statewide and federal offices this year really concentrating their efforts in eastern Montana in these small communities that I come from there. And I know it's been like a wasteland as far as you know, having anybody show up and trying to actually, you know, hear your concerns or, you know, lobby for your vote. It just isn't something that's been happening. So it's really good to see that happening now. But I don't expect Gianforte to follow that same campaign
trail,
and certainly not Steve Daines.
No. And the money, again, I mean, it's, you know, just the amount of money, the sheer amount of money that both of those men have to spend on their own campaign, let alone, you know, the reality that they're endorsed by President Trump. They have the opportunity to draft off of national money because of that. You know, Gianforte, we happened to outraise Gianforte last quarter. I don't know that we can continue to do that.
Right.
We were proud that we did it once because the ability that they have to raise the kind of money that they're going to raise and also self-fund is a problem and a disadvantage. I mean, it's when you look across the board at the type of candidates that can run for office, what do we want in office? We want school teachers. When my father was in the Congress, he was the only school teacher, and that was in the 70s and 80s. We want teachers. We want farmers like John Tester. We want to have regular working folks, and how do they possibly put together the resources that are needed in this day and age? And that's why I think we've got to just keep working at finance reform. We've got to make sure that we continue the good work that Steve's done here in Montana to at least make sure, again, that we have stronger laws in Montana. Again, if federal government's not going to do it, let's do it ourselves. And that's a great example of where Steve and Democrats and Republicans ultimately got that done together.
The Disclose Act, I think. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, just we seem to have come to a point where they're, with Bloomberg spending already pretty close to $500 million.
Yeah.
Startling. That's an exclamation point in terms of self-funding.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think, scaring people, Republicans and Democrats and leaders, because that kind of money boggles the mind. And yet he's not the only one who could do that, right? They're setting a pattern. spending really big money that we can't even conceive of, right?
Yep.
And I don't think Americans want that as representative of how we run our democracy.
Yeah.
No, absolutely not. And then, you know, in a lot of cases, if they're not self-funding or it's, you know, a corporation or a PAC, you know, this, then a lot of people who actually need help from their government end up feeling like they have to support the campaigns of their local politicians, you know, so they're actually taking money out of their pocket in order to try to elect somebody who's going to represent them.
Yeah.
You know, so it's all just turned upside down.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, we're really proud in that finance report that we posted, our first one, that 62%, I think, of our contributions are Montana contributions. And also, we're taking contributions from job creators and friends near and far who want to keep Montana, Montana. And what we know is that it's these campaigns are really expensive. You know, the amount of money that it takes to go up on the air is pretty dramatic. And the amount of money to do mail and to hire, you know, young people to go to the doors and
And this
all
is not even an expensive state.
Exactly.
Right. You know. But that's what it takes. Yeah.
I know. I remember back when my dad was running for the statewide seat. Remember, we went from 2 to 1 in 1992.
Right.
And Marlene was the Eastern District member and Dad was the Western. And they ran what was kind of this bellwether race that year. And I remember him coming home, having had a meeting with his team saying, you're not going to believe this, but they told us that this is going to be one of the most expensive congressional races and it's going to cost $1 million. And I think now $1 million for a congressional race. I mean, I don't know what the all in cost last time on the congressional race with Kathleen and everybody, but it was certainly well more than $1 million. She raised more than $1 million last quarter.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, you can certainly see how times are changing, and not for the better.
No, no. It's,
well, moving
it's
on.
It's got to change.
I don't want to thump our own tub here, but we do want to give the candidates enough time to talk about the things that are important in detail, so you don't have to cut it short for, because we're 30 seconds.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I so appreciate it. Yeah. I will tell you, Mike and I, you know, are obviously running against each other, Mike Cooney, and we've done 2 forums recently. And we get a minute to answer the question. And it's really hard to have a thoughtful answer in a minute. So I do appreciate this format and appreciate what you all are doing to make sure people are educated, you know, about the issues and about us and what our ideas are. And I think it's really powerful and important. So thank you for taking the time.
Well, one of the things we do, we close this off with recognition that the governor is the state chief executive. But a governor also fits into a pattern of 50 other governors who have something to say about what's happening in the United States as in general. And while this may seem like old news now, we are asking every candidate their opinion about something. We have a question.
Great.
And you'll instantly recognize where it's coming from. Do you believe it is appropriate for the President of the United States to ask a foreign leader to investigate a political rival?
Of course
not.
Yes
or no?
No, absolutely not.
And what's the consequence if they do?
Well, we might be about to find out. I mean, you know, we certainly saw interference in the last election, and we'll see what happens this time. But of course not. Montanans don't agree with that. Whatever you think about Trump, and lots of Montanans are supportive of his presidency, that doesn't mean they're supportive of the idea that you have a interference. They're just not. It's unfair and it's wrong.
Right. There's only one way to answer that question. And it's I think a question that applies to any candidate running for any office, because it really says a lot about you know, the morality and the character of someone who's running, if they can't put a simple no behind that question, which, you know, I've asked it of Dane's office, and I've called up Gianforte's office, and they haven't been able so far to say no. And I can call Tester's office, and it's, you know, Absolutely no.
Or so, are you kidding? No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think, you know, Montanans believe in a level playing field. You know, we like our sports and we'll roll up our sleeves and, you know, do whatever we can to win. But not something that's just fundamentally,
right.
Fundamentally yeah. unfair.
Well, that's, I was talking with a very conservative individual I know, and that was, you know, the comment that they made was that what they don't like about what they're seeing from the GOP right now is that they won't play fair. And, you know, a lot of the positions that he supports, he's finding ways to justify staying on that team, but he's moving farther away from it, and it's because he keeps seeing that they just won't play fair. And I think you're right. Montana has, that's the spirit of most Montanans is.
Well, and I think too, you know, what I will say in all these visits, we've just gone to the 24th county on this tour, visiting with folks. People aren't talking about this question or these issues at all. Not a single Montanan has asked me about these issues and the sort of circus in Washington. They aren't thinking about it. They're thinking about what is going on in Montana. Again, they're scared. They're thinking about, how am I going to pay for my prescription? What if the local school closes? Is my kid going to be able to afford to go to college? Right? Where's the future? What's it going to bring? They're not thinking about what's going on in Washington. Now, you know, the federal candidates may be getting more of that, but I will say I've literally not had a single question about any of the circus from anyone.
Yeah,
in 5 months.
That's
interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Whitney Williams, thank you very much for coming in and spending the time with us. And I hope that people listen to this and get a better picture of who you are and why you're running for governor. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, again, a big thank you to Whitney Williams for coming in and bringing her perspective to this. I think people listening to it would pick up very quickly that she comes from the business background, that's obvious, and she brings to the issue of who is the governor and what the governor should do from not just the business point of view, but from, I think, the putting pieces together, the problem solving, the people part of it, where you bring various diverse kinds of people into the issue and try to solve it that way, as opposed to looking at everything from the legislative point of view.
Right,
what
right.
law you can write. What...
Yeah, her background from her own personal business definitely applies to an administrative position like the governor. She seems like someone who would surround herself with people that are informed, and that she would be willing to listen to them in order to solve problems. So that's kind of rare these days.
Yeah, it is. And, but then on the other hand, she has this, I guess you could say, incredible pedigree. She comes from people who were steeped in the legislative process.
Yes, I would say for someone that's never held political office before, she has the richest political background of anybody that we've interviewed. You know, it's part of her nature and nurture. So,
all in all, makes her an interesting candidate. We have said that a lot at this a podcast runs through it, but I think it's this year round, it's really true.
We are blessed with a group of candidates that are well qualified for all the offices that they're pursuing.
So I hope people, you know, enjoy and learn from these interviews. They are intended to give you a broader perspective on each of the candidates and can bring it together, because we're going to come up on the final decisions in a very few months now. And so
right.
to wrap things up, this has been a podcast Runs Through It from Livingston, Montana, the Sound Color Studios. And for I and Dixie, goodbye. Thank you for listening.
Vote.